Hey there, first readers. As part of our continuing Best of First Reading Easter series, this week we have a reprise of our 2019 conversation with the Reverend Dr. Johanna van Wyk Bos, my former professor and a dear scholarly mentor. Johanna is a pioneer among feminist biblical scholars, so it was a real treat to get to talk with her about a challenging prophetic text, Hosea 11. So enjoy this classic first reading episode. Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament lectionary podcast for preachers and all other lovers of the Hebrew Scriptures. I'm Tim McNinch.
And I'm Rachel Wren. This week we'll be covering Hosea 11, the lectionary text scheduled for August 4th, 2019. We're taking a break from our small, bonsai-sized mini-episodes to bring you a full, live, oak-sized episode with a special guest exegete.
That's right. We're so pleased to have with us today Dr. Johanna van Wyk Bos. Johanna taught for 4 decades as professor of Old Testament at my own alma mater, Louisville Presbyterian Theological Seminary in Kentucky. I was fortunate to catch the last few years of her teaching career there during my MDiv, and she was a formative influence on my development as a scholar, in addition to becoming a dear friend. Johanna continues to serve the Presbyterian Church, PCUSA, as an ordained pastor. In addition to her teaching, speaking, and preaching, she's a prolific author and an engaged activist, especially around issues of equity in terms of gender, race, and sexual orientation. Among her many great books, with several others on the way, including a commentary series on Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings with Erdmans, I'd personally recommend to our audience her book, Making Wise the Simple, The Torah and Christian Faith and Practice, which really dovetails with the ethos of our podcast here. So we'll link you to that on our website. Johanna, welcome to First Reading.
Thank you, Tim and Rachel. Glad to be here. Tim was, of course, an able assistant in my classes, so we had fun together. Remember that last class on the Psalms we did?
Yeah, that was wonderful.
That's very cool, I know.
Especially since we threw out half of the syllabus and just had fun with it.
We forgot about syllabuses, and then the singing at the end was so great. That was really cool. It was great.
Yes, yes. Now, am I right? You spent some time recently in the Netherlands where you grew up?
Yes, I was there for 3 weeks.
So could you tell us what's something that you enjoy there in the Netherlands that just isn't the same here in the States?
I get in touch with my roots. So for me, it's always an extraordinary experience in many different ways. This time I was there at a couple of very significant days. The one was Liberation Day, and the other was Remembrance Day of the War. When we say the war, we mean the Second World War always, mm-hmm. because we were occupied, and I was born in that war. So the first comes Remembrance Day, which is huge. The king and the queen come, they listen to speeches, there are wreaths laid at the monument on the dam. And so Then I'm driven to contemplate again the enormous cost that war took. The destruction of Jewish life is always really clear to me. I looked for the name of the little girl that was taken from my village. So it's very much getting in touch with my own past, because it was part of my past and the past of the country, and the fact that all this Jewish life there has disappeared. So that's another thing that it's very important to me. I go to the synagogue at least once, where I seem like a very odd bird. So the next time I'm going to ask my rabbi to write and say, she's coming, and she's all right, you know, she's okay. And I said, well, I said to Rabbi David, but I'm not a Jew. He said, that I'm not going to tell him that.
Johanna, I was interested in hearing a little bit more about how you became drawn to teaching the Hebrew Bible as a career, especially at a time when there were so few women in the Biblical Studies Guild.
Well, like, it was a bit of an odd bird. You know, even as a child, I was a very rebellious child in school, but I also had a very I followed my star very early. So when I was about 12 or 13, I thought I wanted to study theology. That's a ridiculous age, you know, to say I know what I want to do. I mean, it's just insane. But I did take Hebrew, and Hebrew was the only elective in my high school. I had to take five languages, so I took a sixth one. And
as people do,
It was very intense, you know. I had to do Latin and Greek for 6 and 5 years, and then the modern languages, and then I took Hebrew because I thought still, you know, that was what I wanted to do. So there must have been an ongoing kind of driving idea in my mind. So then when I came to university, I loved language, I loved history, but I was in church history. So I veered more to the history part. And then I emigrated. I finished all my exams at home. And then that was a good moment for me to rethink all that. So then I rethought whether I really wanted to be in history or whether I'd rather do Bible. And I got accepted at Union. And I had decided to go on in Bible, which was fine. There was no, you know, there were no barriers to that. And I've never been sorry because the text... Actually, I think the text has so much history, so history was still there, right? And then all my love for language was all there, too. So I've been very lucky, I feel.
That sounds like a perfect place to actually dive into the text.
Yeah. Johanna, would you be willing to read the lectionary text for us for the week?
Sure. So this is one of the more difficult texts. The entire book of Hosea is in its entirety is a horrendously corrupt and difficult text. So everybody knows that. So this chapter is no exception. So you have to look up numerous words, even when you are pretty versatile in Hebrew. And so it's
Johanna, I'm going to interrupt just for a second. For any of our listeners who are far away from their Hebrew training, corrupt does not mean a bad thing. It's a technical term where the Hebrew text does not make sense. The vowels or the consonants are nonsensical, and so you have to adjust it or supply. And that happens throughout the Bible, but especially in older texts. And Hosea is one of the older texts we have. And so it does tend to be more corrupt. Just wanted to put that out there.
Thank you, Rachel. I'm sorry, when I use terms like that, please hold my feet to the fire and correct me on it, because that is a technical term. So what I would probably do if I were preaching on this is I would read it once in the NRSV translation, and then once again. I think the virtue of that is also that people would then really focus more on it. And it would make clear to them that there is a kind of instability in the text, which it's important, I think, for people to know. It should not make them feel uncertain or uneasy. It's far away from us. This text is far away, unlike the commandment to love Adonai our God. It is far away from us and across the sea. So that's a good thing. I would want to establish that first. Mm-hmm. I might also do something else first, but I'll talk about that later. So I'm now going to read it because that's what Tim wants me to do. So this is the whole chapter, Hosea 11, verses 1 to 11, and it goes like this. When Israel was a youngster, I loved it, and from Egypt on called him my child. I called to them, but they walked away from me. To the Baals they sacrificed, and to idols burnt incense. I myself taught Ephraim to walk, took them up in my arms, and they did not know I healed them. With human ropes I pulled them, with cords of love, and I was to them as one who lifts an infant to their cheek, and bent down to them and gave them to eat. They will return to Egypt, and Assur will be its king, for they refused to turn back. And the sword will roam around in their cities and make an end to their diviners and devour on account of their counsels. My people are hung up on turning from me. To Baal they call, and he will not raise them. How will I give you up, Ephraim, and hand you over, Israel? How give you up like Admah and set you up as Tzevoim? My heart turns over within me, my compassion is altogether kindled. I will not act on my wrath. I will not turn to ruin Ephraim, for I am God and not a man, in your midst holy, and I will not come as a destroyer. After Adonai they will walk like a lion, he will roar when he thunders, they will come trembling from the west, they will come trembling like birds from Egypt, and like a dove from the land of Ashur, and I will settle them in their houses. Oracle of Adonai.
So beautiful.
Thank you, Johanna. Well, I'm dying to ask you so many questions about your... That was your translation of this text.
I know you want to ask about why I translated it, but I have also all kinds of footnotes on it here, so, you know, on that... Say, well, I don't know. I don't know whether this is that or that is that. I can give one example. In verse 5, I had, they will return to Egypt, but the Hebrew text there has the word no to begin with, which a lot of people read as he will not return to Egypt. Return. You don't give them to eat. Then you've taken the low with that previous phrase. And Buber has... to Egypt, he must not return. You know, that's kind of a theme in the Torah, that they should not return to Egypt, right? Right. As Egypt being the house of bondage. And Buber reads it literally, which also would make sense. So if you had, he will not return to Egypt, but Ashur will be its king, mm-hmm. you know, that's also mm-hmm. a good reading. And in that case, mm-hmm. I honestly am not sure. But mm-hmm. I'd settle on something and read it, you know, whatever, and not fuss yeah. over it in the congregation, because it's going to be, you know, too confusing, I think, and you just
yeah.
have to.
That's one of the things we do regularly on the podcast is talk about preaching pitfalls.
I know, getting too caught up in the difficulties of intensity.
Exactly. So it'll be good for us to tease out a few of those in our conversation, but we always want to say to preachers that when you're preaching it, don't lose your congregation by getting too lost into the weeds of translation.
Right, sure. There's another interesting one in the first verse when I read from Egypt on, I called him my child. But Buber again has, I called to my child, which you can also do.
Right.
So is it the call, you know, that the parent does to the child, you know, that's just a loving call? Or is it actually naming Israel God's child? It's a different reading.
Mm-hmm. Can I pause? Because you just mentioned that parental imagery.
Yeah.
Which is so strong
right.
in these yeah. First four verses. Can you just sort of flesh out for us all of the parent imagery in this text? And then, so first flesh that out for us, and then second, talk about your opinion on should we talk about this as maternal imagery, as mother imagery, or just stay with it as parent imagery?
First of all, I would never preach on this chapter all by itself like that. It's in the lectionary, I know, and so we're doing that. Because I think Hosea is just so suited to do as a book. It's not a long book. It's very difficult, and I don't know that I would choose it as a book. But if I were preaching from it, I'd do the whole book. And I'd begin with your, you know, the one you did, which is so difficult. And you have the most difficult part almost behind you, right?
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah. So then you can get on with other things. So, but the Bible has many voices. You know, the older I get and the more I work with it, the more I see that our desire to see one thing in the Bible or have one line just isn't there. So there are different voices, and also in Hosea, and there are different voices about God's gender, let's say, in the Bible. But in,
well, within this own chapter,
and
right?
In this chapter. But I think the, and it's, I think the Bible in a way is a lot like the Talmud that way, you know. So in the Talmud, you get discussions, right? And it's very confusing for Christians mm-hmm. that don't know the Talmud, because we're not used to that. But I have now studied for, I think, 5 years every Saturday with a rabbi who really knows the Talmud. And I don't know the Talmud, but I'm beginning to see what's going on there. So one rabbi will say this, and another will say that. And then there's no rabbi who comes in and says, no, you're both wrong. This is the word of God. And that's basically the problem, that we don't have anybody who's giving us the final answer, right? We just need to work with this and see where we line up. What is meaningful? A difficulty with this particular text, I think, is where do we find our place in it, right? We're not the prophet. We're not really Israel either. We don't even compare to that tiny place that was about to be overrun by a huge aggressive empire. So where do we find our place? And I think it is exactly in those statements about God's parental love. The fact that in this text, the parental love tilts to the female is extraordinary, of course, because you would in ancient religions have either a female goddess or a male god, but not one that would incorporate both. So I would emphasize the female. I would emphasize the fact that this is one of the texts, and there are others. It's telling that the particular texts where that takes place are almost all exilic or post-exilic texts.
Yes.
So you have them in Isaiah, yes. Right? In Isaiah 42 and Isaiah 45, Isaiah 49. Those are all second Isaiah texts. And then you have them in Isaiah 60. I discuss all those in Reimagining God. So I was very aware of that. All of those have a maternal image of God.
They do. They all contain that. And then they also, all of the books that you mention also contain the image of God as the angry husband and Israel or Judah
right.
as the adulterous
right.
wife. So it's like this ping pong, this whiplash of imagery
yeah.
of the divine, which goes from the sublime to the horrible.
Yeah, I think it's not second Isaiah, I don't think, has the adulterous wife.
That's first Isaiah.
That's right. So that's a good example of the multi-voiced nature. So there is maybe one image that we can't do anything with today in our much different society and far more patriarchal than ancient Islam. I'm convinced of that. I think our society has gone haywire with patriarchy. So we live in a much more dangerous society. I think there's a war on women. I think we can speak of femicide today. And so these become dangerous images, just like the image of annihilating other peoples becomes dangerous, right? It all depends on the context you're in. I think in the particular context that the annihilation of peoples was spoken about, it was not dangerous because Israel was a province, right? Judah was a little province. I mean, it was ludicrous to even think about them, but it's not ludicrous today. So I think then the context of today is really important in that regard. So I would speak about it because I think it is important to lift up. This is prophetic language, right? So prophetic language is almost always hyperbolic. This is dramatic language, emotional language. So this is not a sort of image, even if God is spoken of as a husband, as a sort of cool cat, you know, in a male box, in the gender box, right? God is not sitting in the gender box of cool, distanced cat. I mean, God is emotional and emotional. So all the metaphors that are in here are so strong, I think, almost impossibly strong. You asked, should we gender God as a mother? I'd say yes, but my focus would be, I would run through some of the metaphors if I were preaching on it, right? Just to bring that out for people, to make that come alive. Do we speak of God that way? You know, do we really understand God to be so moved by our, by our waywardness, let's say, as a parent is about their child. And as a parent myself, I completely tap into that language. Yeah, you know, I calling to the child, and they just walk away, not listening. You know, we don't have the Pesalim. You saw that the images in there, Tim, that were in the Ehud story, right? They're in here also, the hewn images. It's not literal. They get into all kinds of stuff we don't want them to get into. And we call to them and we say, this isn't going to go well. You know, this is, we, and so those, I think those.
We know how this is going to end.
And they don't listen to us. Of course they don't. No. And,
well, not only do they not listen to us, but like in verse 3, it says they didn't know that I healed
them. That is a fabulous image. And actually, I looked into that. In Exodus 15, so much of Hosea calls up the wilderness period, right? The wilderness period is the ideal period when Israel is betrothed to God, or when Israel is a child, right? Israel was not a child, but it's that imagery of not yet a people. When God carried them on eagle's wings, as in Isaiah, in Exodus 19. So. In Exodus 15, that's in that in-between period when they're wandering around after the victory and at the Sea of Reeds, and then they're on their way to Sinai, and there's no good, right? They're constantly murmuring and rebelling and being just their obnoxious selves. And it says right there in Exodus 15:22, I, Adonai, am your healer. I found a number of fantastically interesting places where the self of God says, I heal and no one delivers, in Deuteronomy also. And in Job, it's a statement about God. It's especially a Psalms phrase,
yes.
Who heals all your diseases. We know that one, right?
Right,
what
right.
is that, right? Seeing God as the great medical, the doctor. I mean, it's like, it's so evocative, I think, a hands-on image. So spurning that, right? Spurning that image is goes to the heart of God, right? It's really...
Yeah, you can feel it.
So that expression that God's heart is turning over, I think... That turning over was an interesting phrase because it's hafach, which is the same verb that's used for Sodom and Gomorrah and for Nineveh. Mm-hmm.
And for
right?
Nineveh, yeah.
Yeah. But doesn't that happen? I mean, and Lev, you know, isn't the same. We say that Lev is not the seat of the emotions, but it is sometimes in the Bible.
And this is the whole thing I'm writing on for my dissertation. This is my whole point. No, I think this is so powerful. We have this parental imagery in verses 1-4, and then this moment in verse 5 where God is either offering a declarative statement of destruction, or kind of that more parental, like we talked about earlier, I know what's coming. I know what's going to happen. Would you just listen to me? And then this shift from that, again, this idea of like whiplash in verse 8 of how can I give you up? How could I surrender you? And then this idea of my heart has turned over within me or against me or upon me. And this idea of heart in the Hebrew Bible, lev, is often mind, but really it's both heart and mind.
Yeah.
It's your seat of your reason, the seat of your emotions. And so it's like this window into the divine inner struggle where everything is turning over inside of God.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it feels like, of course, if your child is really... You know that they're on a path of destruction. I mean, that this is coming. So I think, Hosea, that's also very typical for me of Hosea. A seesaw, as I think is what you called it. There's that back and forth. There's a constant announcement of disaster and then these strong emotional statements about the the bond that exists between God and the people, which you have in, you know, this is coming out in this one passage all at the same time. So I thought about, I looked at Buber, as I still do oftentimes, and he says that Hosea is about the love of God. It's about God's, it's the loving kindness. It's the chesed of God. But that love is not demanded of Israel, which is interesting. This is a kind of side thing. Okay, I'm going on this path for just a moment, and if you want to kick it out, mm-hmm. do that. But God's love is demanding. God's love is angry, but God's love is merciful. So in the end, I think it's always the love that trumps the anger. That's why I would want to focus on verse 9, because verse 9 kind of contains all of that. 9 is a great verse because it has all these ideas in it, all these statements, both about anger and about mercy. And it contains the word turn, and that I kept that in the NRSV in verse 9. It says, I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim. But that's the word shuv, and the word shuv is key to this chapter. It has it's a prophetic word. Of course, it means much more than turning around. It means a kind of converting. It means turning away from the things you're doing toward God. And so here it says that God is repentant in a way. Shuv in the prophets is repentance. And so God is repenting. I will repent from my idea to ruin Ephraim, right? For I am God and not a man and in your midst only. But there is something to be said about every part of that, of those phrases. If God's love in the passage is demanding and also wrathful, then there is a promise here that the anger will not be the basis of God's action ever. So then that also means whatever is going to happen to them is not God's anger, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Assyria is going to come. I mean, this is in a bad period of their lives. And it's like the eve of the Second World War. So this is a very thing. Yeah. But it will not be. This actually says that, but not be God's doing. This is not God's thing. It's just the way empires work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it won't be the final end.
It will not be the final end, right. And so... So the place, I think, if I'm always looking when I'm preaching, for where do we find ourselves, right? Where do we find ourselves both as a group of people in a big empire, actually, and where do we find ourselves as Christians in a text about Israel? We're not, and I would want to make that very clear so that we're not sort of making an automatic identification with either as a people with the prophet. We're not the prophet. Because people like to think they're the prophet, right? We're not the prophet. The preacher's not the prophet. It's not the prophet. So we're not to be overrun by a large empire, obviously, as a people, right? But I think there are still powerful forces around us. So there's a link. Once we have established a distance, we could still find links between feeling helpless, feeling that we are in the grip of forces of division and ambition around us that feel overwhelming, that beset us, right? I mean, it's a scary time that we live in right now, I think. So what this verse 9 says is that unlike the powers of the world, which is always a wrathful, angry power, I think, aggression is always built in to empire's power. God's way with the people is not one of destruction, however difficult a line may be, right? The tenor and the content of this passage is not difficult. It's easy. It's easy, in a way, to understand that this is about God's love. This is about God's mercy, even though there is no deserving this mercy because they're doing everything wrong and we're doing everything wrong. So that's not what it's about. Now, I think that the declaration that God is not a man, which is how I would translate it, because I think Ish is always the gendered word, isn't it? It's not Adam here. It's not mortal as the, I think that's what the NRSV may have there.
That's right.
Mortal. That's what a number of translations do. That's fine. I think that's embedded in there also. But I think it's also a gendered word. So what that says is something very interesting. You could probably do a whole sermon just on that line. Because much hatred arises from genderedness, right? So what this speaks to is that what in humanity is divided, is gendered, in God is not divided. And so in the end, yes, it does speak to the fact that that God is not mortal. But saying not a man makes it very specific, I think. So that can also speak to the fact that we're going astray if we identify God solely with male characteristics and a male language and male terminology. And then second, God is holy. So that means that God is other also. And those go together. God is holy because God is not gendered. So speaking of God only in gendered terms is probably incorrect. It was incorrect then. And it's incorrect. Now, that they had that insight, I think, is pretty remarkable. I think where the link with the New Testament might lie is with the notion of idolatry, which I think is there in both the Colossians and the Luke text, that idolatry is a big issue in Hosea. But according to Buber, it isn't just about creating other gods. It's making God into a Baal. That's what he says, it's the Baalization of Adonai.
Now, that is a fascinating view of idolatry that could be really powerful in a sermon, that idolatry is not just, quote-unquote, worshiping other gods, but it's making God into something that God is not.
Right. Yeah. So, for example, then, you know, you could say that the worship of money, the worship that we, that's mentioned, I think, in Colossians, greed, is a kind of Baalization of God. We make this into a god, yeah. And so, in any case, yeah, you could do that. Holiness, I think, is a very interesting concept. You would want to say something about that. It means that God is other. But here it says also this, and that's why that verse attracts me so. It says, in the midst of you.
Right?
So the holiness of God is in the midst of the people. So then it's not just out there, away, it's separate, but in the midst. And then that means that that as a community, Israel was called on to reflect that holiness. That's, you then shall be holy, for I, Adonai, your God, am holy. And, you know, in the Leviticus text, it means that people have to reflect that holiness. So as Christians, I would say there's another hook there, because God, well, there's a couple of things. God is not just with any community. God is with Israel here, right? So we need to say something about that. I would not be following the trail of, well, we're Israel, you know, not that we say it that way, but by ignoring the fact that there is a special election of Israel. You do kind of say that. We've taken that over, right? We are now Israel, so God's now in the midst of us. So I would mention that. I would focus on that and make clear that God is with the people of God, Israel, so that we acknowledge that in a kind of gratitude way. You know, that we as Christians are grateful to Israel for showing us this, the Israel of the past and the Israel of the present, right? It needs to always be, I think, a Christian acknowledgement of indebtedness, which gets us out of that, either ignoring that Israel is or Jews. We can just say Jews and Judaism rather than Israel, so as not to confuse it with the state of Israel. You know, that's another matter. But that Jews and Judaism of the past still for us are the people that we are grateful to. It's sort of the opposite of what happened in the Second World War. But then the community that we are is also calls itself in covenant with God, right? We are in covenant with God as Israel was, as we believe it, as adopted children in the covenant, as Calvin said, right? So we are called to holiness also, required to be other, just as God is other. And that means not being lodged. And here I'm circling around to the gendered nature of the text, not being lodged in angry genderedness.
Even in the mercy of God here is a model for those who are in covenant with God, that just as God here is not acting out in wrath, right. There's a model that we also might temper our own wrath and find ways to act in mercy rather than anger.
But the most difficult part of that text is that anger may be lodged in genderedness. That's a difficult part of it, because we don't want to acknowledge that. So I might choose that as a contemporary issue, you know, because you need to have something that makes this concrete. It's dangerous waters to step into, but what does it mean that hundreds of women die every month here in the United States because they're killed? What is going on here? And what does it mean that we have so many heads of state, all of whom happen to be male, who speak out of anger all the time? If anger is what typifies the powers of the world, then the braggarts and the boasters, right, who are quick to take offense, which is always true about a boaster and a braggart, then like God, we are called on not to come in anger, but in mercy. And that mercy, if God's mercy trumps anger, then our mercy needs to trump anger, right? If we're building ourselves on that model, then...
Well, and that's, I think that you're lifting up, Johanna, that I hear you lifting up, the idea that this text carries a lot of weight. It's a weighty text. It's almost a burdensome text, in that preaching it requires you to go places with your congregation that will be sublime with the paternal imagery and the gorgeous assertion that I will not come in fury. And they will also be really, really difficult, because this text would be tone deaf if it did not speak about anger in leaders, or if it did not speak about issues of domestic violence against women, or gendered domestic violence. This is an important text to preach. At the same time, as a preacher, you have to be very savvy about which direction you're going to take this text that will both challenge and, as you said, Johanna, comfort your congregation.
And you don't want to have people to close up their ears and stop listening, you know, so sometimes that can happen. I'm sure that has sometimes happened when I preached in the past, but you don't want that to happen. So I would advise a pastor just to spend a little time, read a little bit in Kings, in 2 Kings 14 to 17 maybe, and then also spend time with the whole book of Hosea. And not jump too quickly to commentaries, just spend time with the book. Just spend time reading through it. And if you're no longer comfortable with Hebrew, that's fine. Then just read it all in a couple of translations, not in one only. Maybe a King James and then an NRSV and a Jewish Study Bible, the Tanakh, you know, that's all... Mm-hmm. Helpful, so you get a little bit of an idea that this is not a simple text and that it's differently translated. Anybody can do that. And if you still want to look up a word or two, you can do that also. You know, that's how I would. If you're not going to preach on this whole book, just in this chapter, still you need to spend time with the book. You can't just take this one chapter.
Yeah, I think that's a great connection to make. In fact, when I was thinking about how I might advise people to take up this text for a sermon, the angle that I was thinking about had to do with sort of in that kind of a political milieu where we are sort of, as you say, beset by all of these powers of empire. Sometimes there's a desire to feel that we've outgrown our dependency on God and to look to other forms of security and ways to feel that we're safe. And I feel like this text recalls that sense of Israel's childlike dependency on God, and how they had, as the prophet says, kind of turned from that to dependence on other forms of security. And God here is recalling that parental, that motherly imagery, and saying, you haven't outgrown your dependence on me. And I had a professor in seminary, you might know, who told me that prophecy, even prophecy of destruction, is always calling for a response, for a decision on the part of the people.
Yes, it's the boomer line that prophecy never announces a immutable decree. It's always a call to return, right? And yes. A call, this is a call to return, and that the dependency on God means a certain kind of attitude toward one another. So that's why Google says that the book of Hosea doesn't call for love toward God. It calls for the people to reflect that love toward one another in the community, mm-hmm. because it does also talk about righteousness and justice, you know, as it's not a central core theme as it is in Amos, but it certainly does that. So then it's not, then the childlike dependency doesn't mean passivity. So that could kind of, you know, you need to get, of course, away from that. This does speak to God's love as it is of the parent, the mother, especially for the child, but they're no longer children, so they have grown up and they need to reflect that holiness of God in their midst.
I think that's what makes this whole image of this, the when I was thinking about preaching this and leapfrogging up off of what you just said, Johanna, that's what makes this image of a window into a divine inner conflict so powerful. Because I think inner conflict could be an image that we wrestle with every day, right. It's a state that we understand around a number of different things, like Colossians lists and like Luke's talks about. And what we have in this text is a very brief moment of watching God deal with a divine inner conflict and choosing mercy. And I think that's that could be a really powerful preaching point, as well as connected to this idea of holiness in our midst. You know, what does it mean to have holiness? Yes, exactly. It doesn't mean you always feel peaceful about things, and it doesn't mean you never feel conflict. Right. It simply means that when you are in the midst of conflict, you are choosing mercy over destructive. You know, so the Hebrew Bible has a lot of different words for anger, but there was a great article written about when it talks about this particular word for anger, which is also the word for nose. It's always a type of anger which is about to explode into destructive action. So this isn't just anger that's being talked about here. It's anger that has gone beyond the tipping point and is about to cause destruction. And again, all things that I think everybody in our congregation, especially parents, could relate to.
Right. And just, you know, just ask the question directly, saying what reflects holiness in our midst and what doesn't? Mm-hmm. What is it that we need to work on here? What do we need to do today? This is a pressing time. So actually, I think the connections can be pretty closely made, that we live in such a...
Absolutely.
A time of great anxiety. I feel that around me. You know, we feel it. We all feel it. So but we're still dealing with our ordinary daily life, right? So how do we set our course? What is it that we called on at this point? And that's where it would get specific, and just asking the question, what do you think? What do you think we need to do here to get beyond anger, to get beyond being locked into a kind of box of destructiveness? So getting out of that, as God is out of the gender box. God is not in a gender box. That means not being in an anger box in this case. It's a pretty amazing text when you come down to it, don't you?
Yeah, it is.
I think one last preaching pitfall before we wrap up, Tim, if I can throw this out there, is... one of the hardest parts, I'm always aware of, one of the hardest parts with preaching gendered texts is we can often fall into the binary of male gender and female gender. And as a preacher, you just need to be aware of who's in your congregation and who might not identify with the male as angry gender, female as compassionate gender. So even if you do choose to preach that, how might you even trouble that binary that the text lifts up.
Right, because the image of the, if it is a maternal image, which it is a maternal image, it's very clear, the bending down, feeding them, you know, there's a whole raft of things here, that it's not just the compassionate image. It's an image also of healing, of teaching. Mm-hmm. I taught, mm-hmm. right? I taught Ephraim to walk. So it's the mother. If it's a mother, it's mother. It's not boxed in either in certain kind of gender. Right. Compassion is a part of it, but that's also paternal. There isn't anything specifically maternal about that. Is the amazing part, I think, is that God isn't locked into either one of these, right? The saying that God is not a man just means that God is not locked in a gender box, either male or female. Yeah? So if you wanted to preach that particular part of the text, that would be a good way to go, I think.
Yeah.
That God transcends gender, actually.
Yeah.
The God of the Hebrew Bible, that these people thought of that. You know, what kind of an amazing thing is that? It just stuns the mind.
I think we've stumbled onto a really rich text here, and I could see myself doing like a whole month or two worth of sermons on this one text.
Exactly, you could do a year on this text. I swear to you, that this is so rich. There's so much hidden. Oh my God! And I almost never preach from the prophets because it's impossible. I think it's
Johanna. That is not helpful for this podcast. It is not helpful.
That'll go. I know, but it's just it's so hard. It's hard because it's so rich, and you always feel, I've said that, but I left that out, and I've said that, and I left that out, and how do you get wrap your arms around this enormous text filled with all kinds of things, right?
Yeah.
And you can't. So that's
right.
Fine.
Which is also a hopeful thing because we know that this is a corpus that we'll never be able to exhaust.
Exactly, sweetie. And for you too, this is also a hopeful thing because I can promise you, you will never get bored with it. I am not ever been bored with it, and I've occupied myself with it for a long time. I'm never bored with the Bible.
Well, we could talk about and preach about this text for years, as we've said, but we are kind of coming to the end of our time here.
All right, sweetheart.
So this is a good place where we could wrap up our conversation today.
Anytime that Tim is called sweetheart, it's a good place to wrap up the conversation.
Well, Johanna, it's been such a treat to talk with you about this text. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast with us.
It was my pleasure. Delightful to be with both of you and to speak with both Rachel and you, Tim. Thank you.
Now remember, dear listeners, if you're interested in more of Dr. Boss's work, we'll post a link on our website, firstreadingpodcast.com. Until next week, I'm Rachel Wren.
And I'm Tim McNinch. Thanks for listening.